this is a very important or very meaningful person to have on here right now. Moses is somebody I've been following on Twitter for a long time, but not just following for any other reason, but because of the content that he puts out there has tremendously helped me in my business. And not only has the content been good, but he's always been very willing to help. I've reached out to him on before we met each other. I've reached out to him on direct messages, and he's always, or even we scheduled a call, and he's always been willing to help. So for me, he has been the inspiration of my Twitter account and of this event. So for me, I feel very happy that he's here, and he took the time to come all the way from Los Angeles to be with us, here and explain his journey, because if I've benefited from this, I think everybody else can benefit from this, and that's, I just want to give that opportunity. So I'm going to give you the mic. They'll still hear me, but I'll give you the mic. And so, Moses, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I think we were just talking about right now, maybe to give a little bit of context of who you are, what's your business, where you come from, and how you how you've achieved what you've achieved.
Sure, but first I want to say thank you for having me, and lo siento, su inglés es mejor que mi español, entonces lo siento. who am I, and how did I end up sitting here in Spain on the other side of the world? My name is Moses Kagan. I am the co-founder of a company called Adaptive Realty. We buy and renovate and manage apartment buildings solely currently in Los Angeles, within the city of Los Angeles. Over the past 14 years, we have renovated 110 apartment buildings, totaling probably 700 or 800 units. We currently own 53 or 54 buildings with investors, totaling 500 apartments, worth, I don't know, depends on what you think values are today, but given where interest rates are going. But probably our portfolio is worth $200 million. And then we also have a property management business through which we manage our own buildings, but also another 60 buildings totaling about 450 apartments for third-party owners, for buildings that we do not own, we just manage. I guess I should say maybe interestingly for all of you, and we can talk about how this worked, but the total amount of capital that my partner and I put into the business in order to build this portfolio that is now worth $200 million or so is probably like $200,000 or $300,000. Just to give you a sense, the deals that we have with our investors vary, but we, in that $200 million portfolio, we probably own, let's call it 20%, it's blended. Some of them we own less, some of them more, but maybe once we return the investor capital with a preferred return on it, we'll end up owning somewhere in the neighborhood of a blended 20% of that $200 million portfolio. And again, that's with very little outside capital. And we can talk, I guess we'll talk today about how that happened and maybe how you can do it too.
Well, before we go into that, just maybe you can also explain the business model of how, I know, I like how you buy and then you finance afterward, right?
Yeah, so maybe let's talk for a second about traditional real estate private equity in the United States. So, and I don't know what the Spanish term is, but do you guys call it IRR here?
TIR, sí.
Okay.
TIR,
yeah. Okay, so normal real estate private equity in the United States is you buy a building, you fix it up, and you sell it as quickly as possible, and you use as much debt as you can, because you're trying to maximize the IRR. Is that kind of clear? Okay. So we have never done that. We have always felt that if you own really good buildings in a really good location like Los Angeles, that it's insane to sell them. Like, why would you sell a building in an area where it's very hard to build more buildings and there's almost unlimited demand for apartments? So from very early on, our business model has been as follows. We buy with cash, we renovate with cash, and then once the building is finished and all the units are rented and stabilized, we go to a bank and we say, hey, look, what do you think this building is worth? And usually it's worth somewhere between 20 and 40% more than what we invested in the building. And that is enough that historically, this doesn't work today, by the way, because of interest rates, but historically what we have been able to do is get a loan from a bank that allows us to pull all of the investor money back out. So we've taken the investor money to buy and renovate the building, we then get a loan and we are able to give the investors all their money back. And thereafter, we just own it, we collect the rents, we pay the expenses and we pay the loan and distribute the free cash flow to the investors. So it's sort of like a permanent cash machine. Once the investors have their money back, it's like they own this building for free, effectively.
What loan to value do you get?
Good question. Historically, we have been able to get in the range of 65 to 70% loan to value. But the key there is it's not loan to cost, right? Like if we invest $1 million in a building, it's not 65 or 70% of a million. It's the buildings, if we invested $1 million, the building should be worth $1.3 million. And then we can get a loan for 70% of $1.3 million. And if you think about the math, you'll see that that's basically allows you to get all or almost all of the original $1 million back out. Is that clear?
Yeah, yeah, okay. That makes sense. So you end up with all the money back after
Yeah, they typically, I mean, we used to be able to do them in sort of 16 months or so from beginning to end. More recently, it's like 2 years, 2.5 years. COVID was incredibly painful for us, as it must have been for many of you. The construction during COVID was a disaster. Both labor got much more expensive and harder to find. The supply chain, we buy a lot of things that come from China, windows and appliances and things like that. Everything got delayed. So these projects that used to be, like I said, sort of 16-month-ish projects sort of started taking 2.5 years, which is painful. But again, because we don't use debt, typically it wasn't fatal. It was annoying, but not fatal.
Thank you, Moses. I think we've set the stage of this massive achievement of what you're doing. And the question that a lot of people here would be asking, or a lot of people normally ask, is, hey, I'm an operator, I know what I'm doing, I'm good at what I'm doing, but how do I get these investors to give me money and trust me with their money when I don't have a track record, or when I'm just really good at doing the real estate part. I'm not really good at raising capital.
This was my question too.
Yeah. So how do you do? Hi, tell us that story.
I want to be clear. My family had always owned a few tiny apartment buildings, and by tiny I mean like maybe my parents owned 10 total apartments when I was growing up. So I was familiar with the business, but we were not. My parents are not rich. So when we started in the business, the capital came from friends from school and from university. Rapidly you learn you need, real estate is, I'll never forget actually, I sat down for lunch with our first big investor, as a friend of mine, and I told him, I said, you know, I love real estate, I love operating real estate, but I hate raising money. And he looked at me like I was an idiot. And he was like, ding dong, you are in the most capital intensive business in the entire world. You can't hate raising money if you're in real estate. You will not be in real estate very long if that is your, if that's your opinion. And so for me, the challenge has been, how do you, I don't come from a particularly rich family. I don't play golf. I don't know a lot of billionaires. So how do you accumulate capital to do this business that we love and we're good at? And the answer came to me in a weird way. There's a book that I came across probably 12 or 14 years ago called Permission Marketing by a guy named Seth Godin. And the examples in the book are out of date and everything now because it's older, but it's a spectacular book. And basically, the concept is that mass market advertising, the way advertising has always been done, is interruption. You're watching a program on television, the advertiser pays to interrupt that program and show you an ad for beer or a car or whatever, okay? And that's frankly annoying. And it depends on a mass market. And what Seth Godin was arguing was that there is a way of marketing that is not interrupting. It's instead of taking value and ruining the experience, you actually add value and improve the experience. And the way you do it is by teaching. You put out valuable content, people learn from it, and because they get value from your teachings, they are very happy to give you their contact information so that you can keep teaching them. Okay? And then over time, as you teach them, you develop trust. And then when you come to them and ask for a sale, you know, whether it's to sell, you know, a house or a car or whatever, or in my case, to sell an investment, that you have already built an enormous amount of trust and you're starting from a position of strength in that negotiation, that conversation with the customer. So anyway, that was the book I read. And I started writing a blog. You guys all probably remember blogs. I don't know if anyone writes them anymore. Mine is kagansblog.com. I haven't written on there in years, but I leave it up because, for a number of reasons which we can talk about. But for every day for 5 years, the first thing I did when I got into the office was write a short article about some aspect of buying, renovating, or managing apartment buildings in Los Angeles. And you would think, this is a very boring topic, like that, right? I mean, like, who the hell reads a blog about such a dumb topic? And indeed, the readership was tiny. You know, like for a mass market publication, they want millions of people reading, and I had maybe 10,000 people reading at most, okay? However, the 10,000 people who come to read such a specific boring blog, it turns out that they are very likely to want to buy, renovate, and manage apartment buildings in Los Angeles. And so those people became our initial investors, and actually we started a brokerage business where they started coming to me and asking me for help buying their own buildings. And so I started brokering deals. And then there were so many people who wanted me to broker deals that I hired other agents to help broker those deals. And then those people said, hey, can you manage these buildings for us? Can you help us with the renovations? And so we built, and then eventually they said, hey, we would like to invest in your deals. And that is how we built that original capital base through which we started buying our own things. That went on for a while. The problem with a blog is that the distribution sucks, okay? You're dependent for traffic, for visitors to your blog, you're dependent mainly on Google. Someone has to search, how do I buy an apartment building in Los Angeles? And you have to hope that Google comes to them or brings them to you. About 3 years ago, a friend of mine introduced me to what is called finance Twitter, FinTwit. And I don't know how many of you read, I don't know, how many of you are on Twitter? Is it everyone? Okay. Do you guys know, I don't know how many of you are familiar with like English language Twitter. Does anyone know what FinTwit is? Okay. FinTwit is a bunch of public markets investors, people who trade stocks all day. And they're talking to each other about stocks. So that's going on. Then there's Tech Twitter, which is the same thing, but it's a bunch of venture capitalists talking to technology company founders. Okay, So I was introduced to these things, and I realized there wasn't really anyone talking about our business, the business of buying real estate with investor money, all of the interesting weird things about our business that make it cool and terrible at the same time. And so I realized that all that I could do is just start doing what I had done with my blog, which was to say writing every single day. At the same time, every morning I write. And it started to work. Very quickly, people started finding my Twitter page and following me. And shortly thereafter, people started reaching out to me and asking to invest money with us. I now, 3 years later, I have, I think, 87,000 followers. We have raised 40-something million dollars worth of capital from people we met on Twitter. Life-changing. I also run an event that's very similar to this one in America, in Los Angeles, that's, again, based on the Twitter following.
I appreciate you saying you run an event that's similar to this one. No, I've done an event similar to his event. So I find this fascinating. Also, maybe you can also explain that what happens, how is it easier to raise capital because people know what you do?
Yeah, so like a typical, before Twitter, let's say, before blogging, but really before Twitter, imagine you're going to go meet a new investor. Someone makes an introduction, and they say, you know, my friend Iker does real estate. I know you like to do real estate. Maybe you should have lunch. And now your job is to go meet that person and convince them that you are a trustworthy, smart person and who they should invest with. Okay. That's a very hard challenge. The challenge of building trust with someone from the moment you meet them until they're ready to wire you $100,000 or $1 million or $20 million, that's a hard process, okay, to build trust from nothing. If you write every day in an intelligent way, that in a detailed, intelligent way that shows how you think about the business, what you are doing is instead of building trust with one person, one lunch or dinner at a time, you're building trust at scale with thousands of people at once. So that by the time they come to you to talk about investing, you don't need to build trust. The trust is already there. Frequently when investors reach out to me, I start to go into my pitch. I've been doing this for the same pitch I just gave you guys. I've been doing this for 14 years, 100 building. And they're just like, I already know that. I've been reading what you've been writing for 3 years. Let's talk about the specific deal you want to do now. I'm interested in that. But you don't have to convince me that you're smart and know about the business because I already know that because I've been following you for 3 years. So it profoundly transforms the process of raising capital. It turned our business from one where I was desperate to figure out how I could raise money. I would find a deal that was really great. Back then, the deals were insanely good. And I couldn't raise the money. I mean, I did a lot of deals where I never got any ownership stake at all. We just did them for cash fees because I couldn't raise the money to get ownership stakes, if that makes sense. Which, when I think about it now, I would be so much richer if I owned a lot of those buildings that I did for cash, but I didn't know any rich people. Fast forward, what has happened as a result of social media is that we have so much inbound interest that I can capitalize any deal that I want. And what the limiting factor on our business is frankly just my own sense of restraint. Like, what do I think is a fair thing, is a reasonable thing for investors to do? Because if I say that it's reasonable, they'll do it. And so it becomes about my integrity as a person and how and what I'm willing to do and not willing to do.
Mary, it's fascinating. Did you choose Twitter? I mean, you mentioned that you just stumbled across it. Should it have been any other, you know, should we be doing TikToks or Instagrams or?
Maybe. I mean, I know for a fact that there are a lot of people who raise money on Instagram, and I imagine there are people raising money on TikTok too. The reason Twitter is so powerful is that FinTwit and VC Twitter communities. In other words, we didn't have to attract a bunch of rich people to come to Twitter to then read about real estate. It turns out that there are already a lot of really rich people who are on Twitter, and some of them are on there with their real names, right? Many of them would never be on there with their real names. Their name is, you know, Joe562-1748, right? But then when they reach out to you, you find out that they're the chief investment officer at a $1 billion hedge fund, or they're a partner at a gigantic private equity fund. They never write anything on Twitter, but they're obsessive readers of Twitter. They're because they're looking for ideas and to meet interesting people. But until you start contributing, until you start writing, we would never know that. They look like any other anonymous account that you would ignore. But once you start writing, they start reaching out to you and saying, hey, can we meet? The biggest single check that I've ever received from any investor is a $20 million check came from a venture capitalist that we met on Twitter. And he had been reading what I've been writing for probably a year, and he asked me to come to the office. And I sat down with him in his office and I explained what we do. And it was, I think I had one more meeting with his partner, and they said, great, we just had a big exit. We just sold, they were the first money into a tech company that sold for $2 billion. So they had all this cash coming to them that they wanted to invest. It was like two meetings or something, boom, $20 million check, and now we're in business together.
Wow, it's impressive. So what advice do you have for somebody that says, okay, I'm not on Twitter, this is a good idea, right? What are the tips, tricks, or how what would you suggest for somebody that wants to reach that level?
Okay, I have a number of things that I want to say about this, but sort of like mechanistically, like the first thing that you need to do is you need to create at least a one-page website that's called a landing page. It doesn't have to be very complicated, just as to say like who you are, what you do, and crucially, there needs to be an email capture form, okay? Because the problem with building a big audience on anyone else's platform is they can take your audience away from you. If Elon Musk decides tonight that he doesn't like Moses, he can just push a button and poof, everything I've built on there is gone, right? So the good thing about Twitter is you can grow this big audience. The bad thing is it can be taken away from you in a second. So what you need to do is think about Twitter as the top of a funnel. And Twitter is the top, or social media is the top of the funnel. You need to quickly get those people's email addresses. Because once you have their email addresses, then no one can take away the audience. Then you own the connection. It's going back to what I said about Seth Godin. You give value through Twitter, and then they give you permission to continue contacting them. First, that permission is just following you on Twitter. I would like to see this guy's writings every day. But the next level of permission is, oh, okay, like I would like to possibly consider investing with this guy. Let me give him my email address. So the first thing you need to do is have a landing page that allows you to capture people's email addresses. Was that clear?
Yeah.
All right. Then you need to, in your Twitter has bios. I wish we could put it up on there, but there's a bio at the top that's it, where you say, I invest in real estate, I have a family, whatever. You need to put a link in your bio to that landing page. Does that make sense? So like just a link. Okay. That will, as you start to write and grow an audience on Twitter, people will automatically click the link and join your email list. That's the mechanics. That's what you need. That's how you get started. Now, what do? You write every single day at the same time. Ideally, you write a couple of tweets, but at a minimum, one good tweet every single day. I wake up at 5:15 every morning to drink coffee and then lift weights, and mine is 5:45 every single morning. Come hell or high water, while I'm drinking, there will be a tweet out. And even when I'm on vacation now, I'm still doing it. I've scheduled some, I'll do it. So you don't, because once you get the, you're trying to build a habit for the audience. You want them to know that every day at this time, they can find your writing. So you want to write every day. And then the final, I guess, another key piece of advice is detail. Like, there's a temptation to write what are called like fortune cookie tweets. Invest in real estate. Like, all these people get rich in real estate, you can too. Bullshit. It's not helpful. Everyone knows that shit. It's not helpful, right? It's like our business model we do these renovations, right? And a key part of it is the apartments are too big. They're inefficiently designed. Like they're too large for the number of bedrooms they have. So our business is frequently just reorganizing the space to put more bedrooms and bathrooms in so we can charge higher rent, okay? That's valuable information, right? What I just explained to you there, you can fit that in a tweet, and that helps a lot of people that, oh, I understand that. That's that, and it's doing a couple of things. One, it's valuable, right? That's valuable information that someone can take away into their business and say, hey, I wonder if I could reconfigure my own apartments to make them more valuable. But it's also proof to the readers or to the audience that you know what you're talking about. So the more detailed, the more specific that you can be, the more trust you're building more quickly.
I just want to add that for me, writing at the same day, at the same time, also helps me build that habit, right? You say for the...
Yeah, no, I think so I'm interested in the craft of writing. Like, as you can, I wrote my blog for 5 years, and I've been writing my Twitter now for 3. Like, in some sense, I've become a professional writer. I'm a professional writer about a particularly boring and arcane and crazy topic, but I am a professional writer. And so I have read other writers talking about writing. And the consensus, if you, Ernest Hemingway, Joan Didion, you name it, every author that I've read about writing basically gives the same advice, which is get your ass in the seat at the same time, every day, in the same place, and work. And what that does is it trains your own brain to be creative at that time every morning. And so it takes a process of writing that can be quite painful, and it makes it so that your brain is doing it subconsciously, so that when you sit down at that time, at the same time every day, very often you will already know what you're intending to write about, even if you haven't thought about it consciously.
And so you mentioned being very specific, and there's always, I think, the first reaction from a lot of people is, wait, but if I tell people what I'm doing, my competition is going to copy me. How do you manage that?
Yeah,
you
know? I mean, so this has been a problem with my blog. My blog created so many competitors for me. Still, to this day, people are find it, and they're like, I should compete with Moses. And they do. And it's really, really annoying. But what I have realized is the benefits of building in public vastly outweigh the information leak. The opportunity, that venture capitalist who wrote us that $20 million, in a million years, I wouldn't have met that guy. He lives in Los Angeles. I mean, but in real life, how do you meet someone like that? And I have countless hundreds of other examples of similar type things, albeit smaller checks, but same thing. Like, partners at private equity, hedge funds, tech people I would never meet who are calling me to offer me money to do deals and also to offer other kinds of opportunities. We can talk about that in a minute. But it opens up a professional network that is just, it's so powerful. And so, yeah, you're giving up some of your secret sauce, and that's scary. But the benefit of growing an audience and the opportunity that unlocks vastly outweigh the information leak.
Just to circle back, make sure you mentioned you keep the blog. Do you keep the blog only for the mailing list or also for the information that's up there?
At this point, it's irrational for me to have the blog up. In other words, I'm not gaining really any value from having the blog up, and it is creating competitors. So, like, you might ask, why the hell are you, like, why don't you take it down? I have an impulse towards teaching. Like, if I were not greedy, I would be a teacher. Like, I like money, so I'm not. So I'm in real estate. But if I didn't like money, I would be a teacher. Why do I keep the blog up? I keep the blog up because I remember what it was like to start doing this business 14 years ago, with no mentor. My father wasn't in the business. I didn't go to school for this business. I had to figure it all out on my own. And I made so many mistakes. I mean, you name the mistake, we made it. We did renovations without permits. We paid for things in cash. And then our accountant said, you morons, like, we have to file taxes. Like, what do you mean you've been paying people in cash? Like, you name the mistake, we made it, okay? And so it for me, leaving the blog up is sort of a way to provide guidance, to be the teacher, the mentor to younger people that I did not have when I was that age. And so I kind of, the truth is that even though it's not good for my business, I do it almost as like, I don't know, public service or something.
I mean, I highly recommend it. I think you can one day print that into a book of how to do it. I mean, it's amazing content because it allows you to go deeper instead of just Twitter. Just wanted to ask you also, Moses, what's your opinion on Twitter allows for anonymous accounts. So what's your opinion on those?
Well, it's a really interesting question. I mean, it certainly hurts you from a fundraising perspective, right? Like, being the fact that my name is on the account and I'm accountable for everything I say is crucial for trust building. Now, that being said, there have been people who have managed to grow large followings and also to raise a lot of money from Twitter using anonymous accounts. I am uncomfortable with that. I think that part of this is like a little bit like the Wild West right now. Twitter is so good for fundraising, and so many people have figured that out that there is a lot of room for misbehavior. There's a lot of room for scamming people, stealing their money, if that makes sense. And so the idea that anonymous accounts can raise money scares me because there's no accountability. So I think I would recommend, if you are going to go down this path that I'm describing, that you do it with your real name.
Fascinating, fair enough. Should we move into kind of the evolution and talk about Reconvene?
Sure, I mean, so one of the surprising things, I like teaching, as you can tell, and so I grew this Twitter following, and the key reason that I did it was to be able to raise capital. Like very early on, people started saying, hey, I like what you write here. Can you take $100,000 or can you take $250,000, whatever it was. What I have learned is that as your audience size grows, many other interesting opportunities emerge. The first one that I could think of that we did was Reconvene. And so we have this event. We just did the second one this year.
Maybe we should explain what Reconvene is.
Yeah, so it's basically, it's people like you. It's operators of real estate, people who do deals. Roughly 70% are those people. Roughly 30% are just passive investors, people who are just looking for interesting things to invest in. So that's the kind of the mix. People come from all over the United States. Some people come from Europe, Canada, Mexico. And this past year, we had 280 people come. Average ticket price, call it like $3,500, $4,000, something like that. So you can see that's actually a real business. I mean, it's small relative to what we do in real estate, but it's a profitable, serious business. And it's the profitability doubled this year, and I expect it will probably double again next year. And that's an opportunity that it doesn't. There are conference companies. There are companies that put on events, right? Anyone can rent an event hall and get a microphone and some lights and a camera. The question is, can you sell the tickets? Okay? Imagine, though, if you had an audience of, call it 50,000 people, and before you rent the event hall or pay for the camera or the lights or the microphone, you could just put on to that audience, hey, would anyone be interested in coming to a conference? And then lots of people say yes. And these are, okay. Would you put down, here are some dates. Would you put down a $100 deposit? 300 people put down a $100 deposit. And so now you know that you can launch the conference and it's gonna work because you already know that there's demand for it. Does that make sense? It inverts, it's not build it and they will come. It's figure out if they want it, and if they do, then you can just easily build it. It radically transforms business to have that kind of an audience.
And so what's the end game now of Reconvene? Do you want to keep growing that, or do you want to, where do you see that evolving to?
Yeah, we're gonna keep doing, I mean, we'll see if we add another. We have a lot of demand to do an East Coast version, like a New York or something version, and so we'll probably keep growing that. But we have other opportunities too. I mean, I don't want to say too much because we haven't announced it yet, but we're, I'm in talks to launch a business helping other people do what we do in other parts of the country and probably the world. And that opportunity, and it's really serious people with really serious money, and the opportunity is purely because of the audience. It's, again, it's a business that just is totally unlocked by the power of having a big following.
Okay, well, I just to kind of continue that evolution, right, and that train of thought. So you've built the audience, you're raising money. I know you've talked about this before. Maybe you can explain your thought on fees and making sure that this is that sometimes people are saying, well, I'm grateful to get some money, so I'm not gonna, you know, how do I charge investors for this, right?
Yeah. Okay. So let's. I think this is gonna blow your minds a little bit, just given what I know about Spanish real estate. let me just. So on a normal deal, like let's say a $5 million deal for us. We do small deals, but lots of them. So we're renovating 10 buildings right now. On a normal deal, maybe my partner and I will put in $50,000 or $100,000. We will get back in fees, call it $200,000, $250,000. No risk. Immediately, that's happening. However the deal turns out, we're getting paid that. And then if the deal goes well, we end up owning 30% of the building. Like, think what that means. That, remember in the beginning of the conversation when I said we've only used a couple $100,000 of outside capital to end up owning this huge portfolio? It's because fundamentally the mechanics are that we get paid more in cash fees than we put into any deal, and then we also get ownership if the deal goes well. It's a standard real estate private equity model, but it is insanely powerful. In the sense that it's a, I don't know if you have the word, the expression in Spanish, but it's a perpetual motion machine. It doesn't require that I start out with very much money. The growth of our business is not constrained by how much capital my partner and I personally have, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's great. So basically the recommendation is make sure you charge.
Yeah, so you charge. Yeah, okay, yeah. Sorry. I gave Iker a little lecture about this yesterday, and maybe I'm going to repeat it to all of you guys. Iker was helping someone buy a deal. Seems like a really good deal. And because it's the first one he's doing with this guy and he wants the guy to feel good and make money, he's not charging a management fee. And that sounds like a really nice thing to do. And I told him it was stupid. And the reason that it's stupid is the following. Every deal you do, you have obligations. In this case, it's to find a tenant, make sure they're paying rent, make sure that things get repaired, all that stuff, okay. In the beginning, when you're first starting out as an individual, it can feel easy. It's easier to just say, yeah, you know what, I'll take care of it myself. Don't worry about it. I'm not going to charge. Okay. The problem is that you're not going to stop with one deal. You're going to do 5 deals, 10 deals, 100 deals. And the problem if you don't charge is that those obligations that you are building up with each deal, they what starts out being not so bad turns out to be a nightmare. And the way to get around, to get out of the nightmare is to hire people, right? Of course, that's what you do. You end up building a business. My partner and I have 16 employees or whatever it is now. If you don't charge fees, you do not have money to pay the employees. And so you rapidly run into this thing, this moment, okay, you did a 1, 2, 3 good deals, fine. Now you're at 10 and you're buried under all of the obligations from those deals that you did before, and you're spending all of your time doing that instead of finding more deals. And by far the highest value way to spend your time in our business is to find more deals. So you have to liberate your time to do more deals, and that means hiring people, and you can't hire people unless you charge fees. So for those of you who are not, you gotta stop doing that immediately. Immediately start charging a fair fee. Even if in the beginning the fee feels small to you, 50 euros a month, 100 euros a month, whatever it is, even if it feels small to you in the beginning, over time, once you've repeated it 10 or 20 or 100 times, that's the cash flow that's gonna allow you to hire people and build an organization. You have to start, every deal you do, you need to think, what if I do 50 of these? What will my business look like if I do 50 of these? And if the answer to that isn't, okay, I can see how I could have a functional organization that could run 50 of these, then you have to change your structure to make it so that it would be functional at 50.
Thank you. Well, just to kind of last question, just to make sure that we kind of finish the arc or the timeline. What's next, Moses? So now, where do you see you going, right? You've evolved from raising capital on social media or on Twitter blogs. Now events, you've mentioned your next project, but where do you think the end game is here?
Well, I'm trying to build a large multi-generational real estate company. And I mean, 200 million is tiny, as you all know. I mean, we're like a minnow. I don't know what the word is in Spanish, but we're like a tiny fish, right? I would like to build a very large enterprise, but crucially, I'm not in a rush to do it. I think of this as a family business, and I think of a dollar is not worth more to me than it is to my kids, if that makes sense. In other words, I'm fine with doing things now that will benefit me in 10 years and my kids in 30 years. So for me, what's most important is don't blow up. Don't be destroyed. So do things, make money, do deals, all that stuff, but do them in a way where we're not at risk of destroying the enterprise. And so I want to build a very big company, and I'm sure that it's going to be a lot bigger than it is now. Don't know. Will it be a billion? Will it be multiple billions? I don't know. What I know that we're not going to do is we're not in a rush. We're not running to get there. So we're not going to take on the risk of blowing up to do it. And so I don't know how big it's going to get, but I know I'm just going to be doing this for the next like 20 or 30 years, and we'll see how far we go.
Thank you, Moses. I truly appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.